You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
All right, I suppose it's time to get started. Thank you all for being here today. I want to say thank you to Brookings and also to the Center for Effective Public Management. And also thank you to the Center for New Institutional Social Science at WashU in St. Louis for all the help putting this event together. Thank you to Anna for all the help organizing everything. I'm just going to briefly introduce myself. I'm Saul Jackman. I'm on one of the people on that list there. And the two co-authors are also here, Will Howell and John Rogowski. And we really appreciate a chance to present this work to all of you today and to get feedback on it, to see where the conversation takes us. So I'm going to start off by asking John to come up here and just give a few basic thoughts on the book. After that, we'll have the panelists come up, and I'll introduce all of them then. So talk to you. Thank you. I'm going to have John come up. Thanks.
Good morning. Thank you all very much for joining us here today, and thanks also to Brookings for the invitation. We really are excited about presenting our work with you today. Our book is concerned with the question that's interested scholars, journalists, policymakers, politicians, and the public since our nation's founding. Does presidential power increase during war? And if war does produce more powerful presidents, what exactly enables presidents to wield influence during war that eludes them during peace? In answering this question, our focus necessarily shifts to thinking about how political institutions interact with each other. After all, power in the United States is both separated and shared between the branches. So for instance, the courts and Congress both have the ability to constrain the actions of the president. So witnessing an expansion of presidential power suggests that some other institution must be comparatively less influential. So in thinking about the effect of war on presidential power, we ought to think about whether other branches of government might be more willing to approve of presidential actions during war that they might reject during peace. In this book, we focus specifically on how war affects the relationship between presidents and Congress. So the subject of our examination is whether members of Congress are more likely to support the president's policy agendas, both foreign and domestic, when the U.S. fights in large wars. In the book, we examine this question in the context of the large wars our country has fought in recent history, World War II, Korea, Vietnam, the Persian Gulf War, and then the wars in Afghanistan and Iran that began and Iraq, that began shortly after 9/11. Yeah, not yet. So the answer to this question would seem to be a resounding yes. Virtually everything that's been written on war and presidential power converges upon the view that during war, presidents wield powers they cannot possibly wield during peace. For instance, in the Federalist Papers, Alexander Hamilton argued that it is the nature of war to increase the executive at the expense of the legislative authority, while shortly thereafter Madison wrote that war is the true nurse of executive aggrandizement. In the 19th century, European observers of the U.S. system agreed. So Tocqueville wrote that the quote, axiom of science says that war must almost compulsorily concentrate the direction of all men and the management of all things in the hands of the administration. 50 years later, Bryce wrote that, quote, the direct domestic authority of the president is in time of peace very small, but in war it expands with portentous speed. After watching the nation's involvement in two world wars, two of the most famous 20th century scholars of the president, Edwin Corwin and Clinton Rosser, expanded upon this view, which led Rosser to conclude that, quote, another axiom of political scientists would seem to be this. Great emergencies in the life of a constitutional state bring an increase in executive power and prestige, always at least temporarily, more often than not permanently. And over the last several decades, people such as Arthur Schlesinger have written about how war has contributed to an imperial presidency, which has led people such as John Yoo to proclaim that, quote, war acts on executive power as an accelerant, causing it to burn hotter, brighter, and swifter. But there are reasons to wonder about whether this view, in fact, has it right. The evidence that previous scholars have assembled is weak at best. Political scientists and historians that have written on war and the presidency have written evidence that essentially consists of long narratives that say presidents have done extraordinary things during war. But there's no systematic comparison of the things that presidents have done during peace. And we know that presidents, too, have accomplished extraordinary things during peace. So for every extraordinary wartime presidential act, there seems to be some other example of an extraordinary act undertaken during peace. So another reason to question this view is that war is extraordinarily costly. I mean, wars that represent some boon to presidential power, so they must do so in spite of the huge human and financial cost that result from these wars. And, of course, our nation's recent experiences with wars also provide another reason to question the claim. Wars became albatrosses around the necks of Truman, LBJ, and George W. Bush, which might suggest that wars may hurt presidents at least as much as they might help them. We also recognize that not all wars are created equally, and the differences in the nature of different kinds of wars may have different implications for how they affect presidential power. Just as importantly, wars may have different effects across different policy domains. So perhaps, for instance, wars embolden the president's foreign policy objectives, but have virtually no effect on the president's domestic goals. And finally, existing literature in political science provides no reason to think that members of Congress are more supportive of the president's proposals during war than they are during peace, because their roll call voting behavior has a high level of ideological stability. As political scientist Keith Poole writes, quote, once elected to Congress, members adopt an ideological position and maintain that position throughout their careers. Once a liberal or moderate or conservative, always a liberal or moderate or conservative. So if redistricting or retirement or serving different constituencies isn't enough to induce changes in congressional voting behavior, it would seem that no external event, very much including war, will be able to affect the chosen ideological footings of members of Congress. So we used a technique to compare congressional voting records undertaken during war and during peace. We are interested in determining whether the onset of war produces a Congress that is more supportive of the president. So if this is true, when a conservative president takes the nation to war, we ought to observe some shift in congressional voting behavior that moves in the conservative direction. Here's our evidence from the 107th Congress, which began meeting in 2001 and 2002. The vote for the authorization for the use of force in Afghanistan occurred in early 2001. So we compare the peacetime voting records, that is, before October 2001, with the wartime voting records after October 2001, for members of the 107th House and Senate. So in this plot here, the curves show the distribution of member voting records during peace, where larger numbers along the x-axis reflect increased conservatism. Here are the wartime estimates. The solid lines here now show the distribution of voting records once the war began. So in both the House and Senate, we see a pronounced shift in the conservative direction toward the general ideological orientation of then-President George W. Bush. So we now look at the individual-level shifts in member voting behavior. The x-axis here show the peacetime voting record estimates for members of Congress, and the y-axis show the wartime estimates for members of Congress. If member voting behavior was consistent before and after the beginning of the war, we would expect to see the points line up along the 45-degree lines shown in the figures, but instead we see that the overwhelming majority of members exhibited substantially more conservative voting records in war than they did in peace. We used the same general approach to evaluate changes in member voting behavior in earlier wars. In the plot on the left, we show the changes in member voting behavior when the nation goes from peace to war. Shifts to the right indicate that Congress has moved in the ideological direction of the president, toward the president. Here, each war provides at least some evidence to think that Congress was more accepting of the president's proposals during war than they were during peace. But the evidence for two wars in particular stands out, World War II and the war in Afghanistan and Iraq. Here, voting records in Congress shifted dramatically in the president's ideological direction in both chambers. Contrast this evidence to the wars for Korea, Vietnam, and the Persian Gulf, where the effects appear much more limited. The conclusion of war, however, has almost a uniformly negative effect on presidential success in Congress, as the plot on the right shows. In all these wars and almost across all chambers, the members of Congress move away from the president's ideological orientation once war is over. The evidence shows here that wars do in fact have an effect on presidential influence in Congress, but that not all wars have the same effect. What might explain the wartime effect we observe, and what explains these differences across wars? To explain the general intuition, take a look at some of these war posters distributed during the two world wars. These posters implore Americans to eat less bread, to grow your own fruits and vegetables, be ever mindful of food waste, use carpools to reduce rubber consumption, knit socks for the troops overseas, plant victory gardens, to keep a low profile to avoid spilling information to spies, and well before ethanol subsidies became a political issue, serve corn at every meal. These slides capture an important dimension of war. Wars have the potential to nationalize our politics and to shift our attention from our own local concerns to the concerns of the nation as a whole. Former Speaker of the House Tip O'Neill famously quipped that all politics is local. And surely local interests are an important part of how members of Congress evaluate public policy. But in the book, we argue that policies have implications both locally and nationally. So, for instance, some trade agreements may have relatively minor effect for the national economy as a whole, but they're hugely beneficial for citrus growers in Florida. And when wars nationalize our politics, when wars demand our efforts as individuals and families and communities to support the work our troops are doing overseas, or when wars pose a grave threat to our national security and our way of life, wars fundamentally alter the ways members of Congress think about the crafting of public policy. Then in these cases, members place greater emphasis on the national implications of policy and less emphasis on the local implications of policy. In so doing, this advantages the president. First and foremost, presidents serve a national constituency, and the whole of the executive branch is designed to help him do so. By matter of design, members of Congress serve their own local constituencies. The nature of these different constituencies suggests that members of Congress are more inclined to support the president's proposals when policy outcomes become nationalized. The theory I've sketched out here provides some insight into why war could increase presidential influence and why it might do so in some wars than in others. It also suggests that we might see different effects across policy domains. So, for instance, the president has a natural advantage in foreign policies, but his domestic proposals are often the source of real conflict with Congress. But if wars nationalize our politics in the way I've described, we ought to see bigger effects for presidential influence for the president's domestic agenda. So looking again at the 107th Congress, this is exactly what we see. The shifts in congressional voting behavior are considerably more pronounced in domestic policy than they are in foreign affairs. So not only do presidents have broad latitude in the conduct of wars overseas, but those same wars also have significant consequences for the policies the president wants to enact at home. We assembled a variety of other evidence that tells the same story. In the realm of budgetary politics, for instance, we compared presidential budget requests with enacted budgets. We show that presidents' budgets receive a more favorable hearing from members of Congress during war than they do during peace. And once again, the effects for budgets are larger for World War II and the post-9/11 wars than they are for the other wars. And we again find that the evidence is stronger among domestic agencies than it is for defense agencies. Other examples from history support our contention that wars nationalize our politics, and when they do, presidents stand to gain from them. Presidents Roosevelt and Bush were able to score legislative victories in Congress that eluded them as peacetime presidents. Now, for instance, in the book, we detail the story of Roosevelt's failed efforts to pass labor reforms early in 1941, but once the nation entered World War II, the president had a distinct advantage in implementing reforms that later historians would argue changed the course of this country's labor policies to advantage unions. But there are also some other examples that seem to challenge our keen claims. So, for instance, during his presidency, Eisenhower tried time and again to reform the nation's education system. But time and again, his proposals failed. Until, that is, fall 1957. In October and November, the Soviets launched the Sputnik 1 and Sputnik 2 satellites. Well, and virtually overnight, support for national education reform sprung from all corners. In doing so, the president argued, was imperative to advancing our science and technology so we could keep up with the enemy. And Congress fell promptly in line. War is not the only factor, therefore, that can nationalize our politics in ways that advantage the president. The story of Lyndon Johnson presents another challenge. We don't find that the Vietnam War led to a huge boon in Johnson's success in Congress. In fact, to the contrary, while Johnson was convinced of the necessity of getting involved in Southeast Asia, he also wanted to preserve the elements of his sweeping domestic agenda here at home. The involvement in Vietnam, he reasoned, would fracture support in Congress for his Great Society proposals by providing Southern Democrats with the argument that we couldn't afford his domestic proposals because of the war efforts. Thus, time and again, Johnson downplayed the true extent of the nation's involvement in Vietnam, insisting before Congress that our foreign policy had not changed, and further deliberately misleading the public about his true intentions. But he did so in an effort to save his domestic agenda. But when he could no longer deny that the U.S. was involved in a full-fledged war, he was forced to announce in spring 1968 that he would not be a candidate for re-election. While the book's findings center squarely around the effect of war on presidential power, we also want to call attention to the various dimensions along which our country's leaders evaluate policies. Sometimes our nation's politics are intentionally local, and at other times our gaze is fixed primarily at the national level. And when we shift between one and the other, we have the potential to see dramatic changes in the political outcomes that result. Well, I'd like to bring our panel up, and we look forward to the continued conversation on the book.
All right. Thank you, John. I would like now to take a moment to introduce our three panelists that we're very privileged to have here today. Starting on the end, we have Sarah Binder. Well, we have Sarah Binder, Tom Mann, and Dan Balls, of whom I'm expecting most of you know these people pretty well. Sarah Binder is a colleague of mine here at Brookings Institution and also a professor at George Washington University. I'm going to try to keep these short, as I've been instructed by the discussants not to brag too much about them. Tom Mann, also a colleague here, and a well-known, both of these two are very well-known scholars on Congress and the American politics in general. And then Dan Balls at the end, as a correspondent for the Washington Post. He's been there for, I believe, over three decades, worked at the White House. Can't say enough about all three of these people. And I'm going to now turn things over to them. I have a couple questions just to kind of start things off, and then I want to really get their feedback on this project. So, Sarah, I'd like to start with you. And sort of given your background in legislative studies, my question based on this book is, does the policymaking process in Congress change during times of war, and if so, in what ways does it change?
Okay, great. Well, first of all, thanks very much for including me for the authors that you are. Okay, great. Let me just start off by saying a couple things that I like particularly about the book, and then we'll get to Saul's question. First, in terms of its strengths, I see three of them. First, this is a thoroughly ambitious theoretical venture from start to finish and quite faithful to the theory almost all along. And in part, not just a theory of wartime, as they point out, war is not really in the model. This is really a theory about Congress and the president and their relationship in policymaking, particularly in wartime. It was really quite impressive accomplishment. Second, the empirical evidence, which you got a taste of from John here, is really very impressive. If you dig into the book, you can see the amount of effort it took to create these pretty unique types of empirical evidence. I was going to say it knocked my socks off, but I didn't. Somehow I forgot to wear socks today. So if I was wearing socks, I'd say it knocked my socks off. Please don't tell my mother. Okay. Or my kids. Anyways, third, methodologically, which we don't need to go into here, it's really they leave no stone untouched. Right? Any objection you might have here, they have thought out already. Right? That is, they anticipate the types of objections, and they try to answer them in the text of the book, which is really quite impressive. So overall, I'm quite quite enthused about it. In response to Saul's question, so the question is really how do I see your findings in relation to my book, which looks at the relationship of Congress and the president and their ability to solve problems, right? How do we account for episodes of legislative stalemate or patterns in legislative stalemate over the post-war period? And so there are really two periods here that stand out from your book where we see this intense nationalization of politics that John pointed to as being critical, right? What are the periods in which members of Congress seem to feel that their local orientations have to be subsumed into a national interest, in part because they don't have enough expertise to challenge the president? We can come back to whether we think members actually check their local orientations ever at the door. I'm not so sure. But in terms of the two periods here, certainly World War II and certainly the war to post 9/11. World War II is a prior to my study. I'm happy to come back to Congress during World War II. And to some extent, it fits your theory. To some extent, it's a little bit of a challenge. But certainly in the contemporary period here, the question is, if we look at patterns of legislative gridlock on domestic policy and patterns on foreign policy, are they really quite similar, right? Do presidents tend, in periods of war, particularly post 9/11, when they succeed on foreign policy, do they also succeed on domestic policy, which is really the shining empirical finding in your book? So-so. I give you a so-so. If we look even just at 2001, 2002, and we can go back to why I say so-so, right? 2001, 2002, clearly, as you suggest in your book, 9/11 changes the agenda of Congress, right? And that, I think, is pretty important. Sometimes we don't quite give enough attention to. Certainly, Patriot Act, authorization for military force, economic stabilization, airline rescue bailout in some ways in that period, right? All sorts of economic issues that come onto the agenda as well as security issues. And so, yes, war has an effect here on the types of issues that get discussed. And on those issues, if we take a look at Congress's record on all the big issues that were put on the agenda in the wake of 9/11, how well did Congress and the president come on those issues? The success rate is something like 95%, right? There's very little left on the table at the end of the day there that Congress wasn't able to successfully address, which in part, right, it really supports your finding here that regardless of what members think in these periods of nationalized focus and security threat, they're willing to vote with the president. So absolutely. The only issue here is if I look at the rest of the agenda, domestic policy issues in 2001, 2002, even those just in 2002 after 9/11, President Bush didn't fare so well, right? By my metric, it's about half the issues are left in limbo and gridlock at the end of the Congress. Prescription drug bills, patients' bill of rights, there was stem cell research, right? A host of domestic and social policies that later saw enactment. But not in that original period. So the question is why, right? How do we account for the differences between your study and mine? Just very briefly, there's a narrow empirical answer, I'm sure, right? Or what we're trying to explain is a little different. I'm into problem solving. You have efforts on budgets and voting outcomes. I think the narrow empirical answer is probably not that interesting. The broader theoretical answer, I think, in part depends on the theories here, right? Yours is an informational model. It has to do with expertise and members' willingness and ability to challenge the president. My model really gives a starring role to political parties, all right, which are don't really play a starring role in your account. And so the question is, if we look at the role of impacted parties, whether it's divided party control versus unified party control, if we're looking at parties which have a large bipartisan middle versus parties which are polarized, once we take account of those factors, we tend to see a divorcing in the success rates between domestic and foreign policy, and such that we might even say that party becomes the decisive factor, right, in explaining why and when members, at least in this context, are willing to acquiesce for president's calls for war. There's a good degree of overlap between our two books and approaches. I think probably the question of political parties and their role here, which Dan and Tom probably would love to talk about as well, might provide a different perspective on president's success in this nationalization of the issues. But I'll stop right there.
Thank you. I'd like to give each of the discussants a chance to talk before we delve into responding to each other. But Tom, do you have general thoughts you'd like to ask? Or I have a more pointed question for you if you'd like, but I'm happy to hear your general thoughts first.
Okay. I'm I'm never at a loss for words, but that's not the problem. The problem is the opposite of that. Mm-hmm. First of all, congratulations to the authors. I mean, this is the subject, the interbranch relations, the president of the Congress, and war making. Marvin Kalb is here and has thought lately about this. My first years at Brookings, way back in the last century, were dedicated in part to the issues of the respective sort of powers and responsibilities, and it ended up with the title "A Question of Balance," just trying to figure it out. And as you point out, John, in the presentation, these questions go all the way back to the early period under the Constitution and into the drafting of the Constitution. They're really critically important questions. And over the years, indeed the decades and the centuries, we've wrestled with them. Aaron Woldofsky helped us with this concept of the two presidencies, one on the military foreign side, the other on the domestic, and seeing a sort of sharp difference between the two. But that's precipitated a lot of subsequent research and challenge, to be sure. But I'm sort of taken by the effort. I think this is, as Sarah said, a really ambitious effort to try to understand what the broader impacts are and what under what conditions and the way in which we sometimes separate domestic and foreign policy is really mistaken. The two are linked together. The question is, what's the form of the linkage? Like Sarah, I am struck and have been struck just because of the nature of the work I've been doing on just how important party is and how much party trumps institutional matters in the period in which we operate now. It's been it's just stunning to see your analysis. Your data set stopped in the about 2006, 2005, and since then it really has been intensified, such that at least one would want to ask the question of whether the kind of focus on sort of the informational theoretical focus and ultimately the focus on the individual member of Congress is appropriate in a period in which we have team battles. That's something you understand full well and talk about it. I'm just raising it as a as an important issue in trying to grapple with that. A couple of other questions that occur to me just to get you guys to talk about this is you're looking at the impact on presidential power, but I mean, what does that mean? In the short term, sort of a little more favorable support in Congress from presidential requests on budgets and on broader issues that elicit a ideological response, but wouldn't it be the case that we'd want to look at what the statutory and institutional implications of the war-making periods are that then take on a life afterwards that you wouldn't necessarily see reflected in the voting of Congress? That is what, I mean, the Patriot Act just jumps out. I mean, that is the mega act after 9/11 that constitutes and includes many of the domestic achievements you feel Bush had. Some of those are really quite long lasting and still under consideration. So the question I ask is, what's the best way to understand the strength of the presidency in a war-making period going into war and coming out of war, and should we be looking at these sort of these institutional statutory accretions, and are they reversed? Are they lasting? Is this in part what accounts for a general increase in presidential authority on many of these matters over a long period of time? So that's one question I would put to you. A second is the national sort of versus the local, I think, is theoretically very important, but it's sort of sometimes tough to differentiate them. As Sarah said, you know, members of Congress never put their constituencies aside and are viewing some of these national mobilizations through the lenses that their own constituents are using. But it's sort of also the case that you are interested theoretically in not just war, but other kinds of issues that would prompt this kind of national focus. Well, we've had a textbook case of that since the end of your data set, which is the economy, the global financial crisis and deep recession. This issue has overwhelmed, in a political sense, all other considerations, and foreign policy is very much caught up in the global economy and how it impacts back home here. And that's the classic issue, I think, in which the local and the national merge, but they combine to push the most of the war-making matters off to the side. Maybe it was because we were withdrawing troops, then adding in Iraq, then adding them in Afghanistan, but then quickly returning, and so that's pushed off the agenda, and Benghazi is pushed off the agenda. So I'm wondering if in a formal sense, your war period would continue because we're still involved, but it's not war that's driving presidential versus congressional authority. It's very much the economy, which gets to the final point, which you raise very nicely in the conclusion of the book, which I think is really fertile and important, which is the whole nature of war changing. And will that over time alter the way in which we come to understand the impact of war making? I mean, you know, we have a difficult time seeing the beginning and the end of wars. We have involvements. We've now had two engagements that are the longest in history, but they haven't been always hot wars, or they're localized, but without a draft. We managed to keep them off the public agenda. So how do we think about war and war making in periods when war is fundamentally different? It never ends. It's a constant types of interventions and anti-terrorist activities. This, of course, then invokes all of the questions now surfacing with the NSA and in the intelligence community. And, I mean, does the ongoing existence of the new war give the president now strength in the face of congressional concern and anxiety about a potential overreach with the NSA? Well, those are some of the questions. There are many more that just naturally emerge from what is a very fertile piece of scholarship.
I want to echo Tom and Sarah on saying what a terrific job you guys have done with this book. I mean, it's obviously very timely, and particularly because we're sort of at this moment when there are questions about what are the limits or of presidential power, and, you know, how effective can a president be in this time? And this is a reminder of this larger reality of the relationship between Congress and the executive, and the tension that's built into the Constitution. I mean, I was struck by this book being a wonderful sort of combination of marrying historical context with empirical research in a way that advances our knowledge about the basic question in a way that is academically rigorous and yet accessible to, you know, the non-social scientists like myself, although Appendix A was a little difficult for me. For those of you who have
You didn't get through that whole appendix?
Pages 275 to 291 are all equations, and I sort of broke down at that point. But up to then, it was terrific. So, count that as the limits of journalists, not the problem of social scientists. So there are a number of ways we can spin off of this, and Sarah and Tom have pointed to some of them. I mean, one of the things, as I say, that's it's a reminder of the tension that has always been there since the founders between presidents and Congress, and the degree to which presidents use periods of war or conflict to enhance their power, either temporarily or more permanently. But as you go through the sort of timeline of conflict, one of the things that's striking to me is the degree to which wars are no longer all-consuming in this country. I mean, if you think of the World War II experience and the posters that John put up on the board, I mean, this was a national effort that consumed the entire country and therefore affected, you know, all citizens, all politicians, and obviously the people who were fighting the war. Since then, and particularly in the last half century, when we think of these periods, we really do think of them as times in which almost for both the country and for presidents, there was a bifurcation or at least an effort not to allow war to completely subsume everything else. I mean, you talk about LBJ in the Vietnam War and trying to preserve an incredibly robust domestic policy agenda, the Great Society, particularly in 65 and 66, by hiding, in essence, the nature of what they were doing in terms of the buildup of the Vietnam War, while pointing out very smartly, I thought, the idea that it was important to Johnson to show Southern Democrats that he was doing what he could to roll back communism, and this balancing act that he was trying to do, and yet to do it in a way that allowed him to, you know, the famous, you know, non-trade-off guns versus butter, ultimately, as you suggest, to his detriment. And the country was torn apart by the war. At the same time, there was the push on the domestic front with the Great Society. You look at all presidents almost without exception through the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, you get to George W. Bush, and the attacks on 9/11, as we know, fundamentally changed his presidency. And so you would say for George W. Bush, the attacks of 9/11 and therefore the launch of the war in Afghanistan and in Iraq were a reflection of the degree to which he had changed his own thinking about the presidency. And yet what we know about the country is that the country snapped back fairly quickly after 9/11. I mean, as Tom points out, the Patriot Act may be the single largest effect of the post 9/11, you know, atmosphere in Congress in the country, and yet we quickly got back to partisanship. The midterm elections of 2002 were extraordinarily partisan, in which the Bush campaign or the Bush team used the war to enhance his prospects in the midterm election, thereby I would say heightening the partisan tensions that existed after that. What we've seen is presidents attempting to advance domestic agendas at the same time they've been involved in conflict. And one of the things that I think is useful from the book is, again, to remind people that not all wars are created equal in their impact domestically. World War II, yes, it obviously did have an effect. Vietnam War, not so much. Desert Storm, which was a very successful military enterprise, you know, George H.W. Bush put together an international coalition, waged the war very effectively, stopped the war, and yet domestically he was seen as a political failure, ultimately to the point that he was rejected in re-election in 1992. Bill Clinton, who fought limited wars, and those are harder to measure in terms of their impact domestically. But was, you could say that while he was, waging conflict in, Bosnia and Croatia and was, certainly not the first president to be dealing with international terror. Reagan was dealing with that too in the 1980s. But the first in the era we think of as the Osama bin Laden terrorism era, he was dealing with that. And yet you would have to say he was a domestically focused president. President Obama, as Tom said, both wound down one war, enlarged another war, then wound down that war. It's striking when we look at what has happened to him more recently, the question of, we think of presidents having almost unlimited ability to decide if they want to start a conflict. And what we've just seen with Syria is his effort to say to Congress, I want your approval before we do anything, and being faced with a defeat in Congress until John Kerry kind of miraculously, unexpectedly and accidentally created an exit ramp for him to do that. There are a couple of things that I was also struck by in the book that I think are worth throwing back to you all for questions. We're talking about Bush and the powers that he accumulated immediately after 9/11, and the empirical work that you did to look at overall, through a long period of time, the impact on budgetary requests and appropriations of a president, and to show that during wartime presidents have been more successful. You raise the issue rightly, I think, of what happened with Social Security, which was the single most significant domestic initiative of Bush's second term, at a time when we were involved in wars, obviously at a time when there was growing dissatisfaction with Iraq. That was a wholly unsuccessful enterprise domestically. He got nowhere on Social Security. And it raised for me the question of the difference between success in a budgetary sense in which individual policies are not so highlighted. We're talking about amounts of money and presidents' success in getting more during wartime for their initiatives across the board, domestically and national security-wise, versus non-war, versus a very big and singular domestic initiative in which the public or the Congress is wholly focused on that, as opposed to kind of the budgetary things, and whether there is any pattern to that can be described in terms of the effect of presidential power in wartime activity. The other question that I would raise, and that is, it's obviously difficult to measure, I think, but that is, to what extent do military setbacks affect presidential powers and the relationship between presidents and Congress? I mean, you think of Jimmy Carter and the failed mission in Iran, where the helicopters ended up crashed on the desert. You think of Reagan and what happened with the Marine barracks in Lebanon in 1982. We are in an era in which small conflict, and as Tom suggested, constant intervention is more the norm than the big wars. And I think that, it's not the focus of your study, but I'd be interested if you guys have any thoughts on the era that we're now in, and how that may affect the relationship. But at any rate, I want to commend you on a terrific piece of work.
Nice.
Thank you. Thank you, all three of you. So many questions were raised, I almost don't know where to begin. But one thread that I felt you all touched on, and I'd love to just kind of push forward on this a little further, is Sarah started off by talking about, the role of divided government as opposed to the role of war. And my first response would be, admittedly, the divided government does play a role in the ability of Congress to get bills passed and the ability of the two branches to be able to negotiate with each other effectively. But does one exclude the other? I mean, could war play a role despite the concurrent effect of divided government? We look at look at the post 9/11 attacks. We had unified government for the first 6 years, then divided government. We had periods of unified and divided government in the previous wars we look at. Maybe we could look at even just thinking about post 9/11, and this goes beyond our data set, but you think about also Obama then having unified government for the first 2 years he's in office, and then divided government thereafter. If you think of that as the same war or not, it's in and of itself an interesting question because, as you said, the economy became an issue. I don't want to get too many issues at once. But, what do you guys think about the idea that this is that this role of war is playing an important factor on the bargaining between the two branches in conjunction with the role of unified government? Certainly, I know in our models, in our empirical studies, we try to control for the effect of unified divided government, for the number of seats that the president's party has in the House and the Senate. We tried looking at a number of different things to see if the effect went away, and we found that that mattered. That had a huge effect on things, but it did not negate the effect of war. So what do you guys think about that, any of you?
So this isn't the only answer. I'll throw one out, and then you guys can think. You guys have a chance to look really sharp, because I'm just like letting the words spill out. That's okay. I'll take the hit. Okay.
So, thank you, sir.
So here's the question. And there's a narrow empirical answer, but that's a little boring. So we won't go for the narrow empirical one. So I guess the question is, if we're looking at the impact of party control here and war and whether one or the other or both might make a difference here, I think the key issue here is what is the, with apologies for the political science-y language, what's the causal mechanism under your results? Why do we see the relationship, this fusing of congressional and presidential interests, whether in budgets or in policy votes or what have you? Why is it? And you have a very persuasive account about informational costs, right? And the nationalization here, and president and members willing to sort of subsume their interests in this broader, because they don't have the expertise to challenge the president, as is clearly part of the story here. Now, in that story, we need to really worry so much about party control. But if there's another mechanism here, right? What if it's just a story about blame avoidance, right? That members don't want to have their hands on the wheel, objecting to what the president's doing, particularly when in national times of national threat, and so they go along with the president. Well, then party control might begin to make a difference because it provides some variation in parties' willingness to give up the blame game or to play the blame game. Right? And then we see a little bit, the current period is a little hard because we've got split congressional control and other control here. But we could imagine a scenario, 9/11 perhaps, it's hard to know, the Lyndon Johnson period, right? We can imagine a scenario where the parties see their exact interest in not challenging the president because they don't want to be blamed because of the horrific scale of an attack. Pearl Harbor clearly falls in that episode. But we could imagine other episodes, perhaps these smaller skirmishes, where the opposition party in control of the House and Senate says, wait, we're going to stand our ground here. This isn't such a popular war or such a threat, and we're going not to subsume our interests here, not to be so supportive. And so I think if we take an account of perhaps a blame game that's going on, we might say we need to think about parties. And if we think that the parties are more willing or more skittish about being blamed, perhaps as the parties polarize because their electoral interests differ, perhaps it's going to play a role too. And we have to sort of think out why and when they might make a difference. But perhaps the answer here on parties is, well, how does it change the calculations of leaders, and has it changed the calculations of rank and file, and whether those calculations differ first depending on the security threat, as well as depending on the relations between the parties.
But I mean, I think Sarah's right, and I think all of us are saying in seeing and saying some of the same things there, and you are too. There are wars and there are wars, but there's been nothing like World War I, and most of our wars since then have been very unhappy occasions, have led to clear opposition developing sort of very quickly, and it becomes so much harder to define or to think through how the politics of war making actually are able to enhance presidential authority and power beyond the immediate, and that's why I keep coming back to the Patriot Act, because most of you discuss very nicely the how some of Bush's immigration agenda got combined with the Patriot Act and gave him a victory. But he wanted what much more, and you mentioned that as well. As Sarah said, you answer all the buts. You don't leave any of these stones unturned in the book. But the politics of that just overwhelmed his 2007 immigration bill. It was a tremendous setback, and it told us something about the changing character of party polarization, and in particular, what was happening within the Republican Party. All of these are factors. But of course, the answer is it could be both, and there are periods in which elements of war, and 9/11 is the closest because in some way the nature of the attack got the country's attention and the Congress's attention and clearly altered behavior in the short term that allowed Bush, it gave him a 90%+ approval rating, and put him in a position to achieve a lot. There's just no question about it. But if you're looking for impact on domestic politics, is probably his biggest changes occurred with his tax cut, initial tax cut before 9/11 and the war, and it's not explained by the war.
I'm gonna pick up on one thing that Sarah said, which is this notion of blame avoidance, particularly at a moment in which the country is embracing a president's decision to want to wage war. We've seen some powerful examples of that in our lifetimes. You go back to World War II and the attack on Pearl Harbor. That was obviously a unifying moment after a direct attack. But there have been a couple of other instances where presidents have sought and gotten significant authority to go to war that have been based on deception. Obviously, the Tonkin Gulf resolution, which we now know in retrospect was totally based on deception, and Bush's request for an authorization to go to war in Iraq based on the belief that there were weapons of mass destruction there, which turned out not to be the case. And if you look at the way Congress responded in the Tonkin Gulf resolution and in particularly the resolution in 2002 on Iraq, I think there was a lot of what Sarah describes as blame avoidance on, particularly on the side, on the Democratic side, in that case where they might otherwise be opposed to what Bush was trying to do. James Carville has always said he thought that Hillary Clinton lost the nomination for the Democratic presidential nomination in 2008, the millisecond she cast that vote in 2002, and yet we know what the politics were of driving that and the inability of members of Congress to really be able to exercise clear and dispassionate judgment at a time when there is a kind of an overwhelming political sense. The issue of divided government and party control, I think, is very important. And I think that in one sense, we're dealing with two different eras over the time period that you all are dealing with in your study. Tom and Norm have done the work on what this new era has presented us with in terms of the conflict between the parties and the role of the Republican Party and the Tea Party faction in affecting polarization in Congress. But we are in a more polarized period today, and so the issue of divided government is more significant today than it used to be. Again, I think that's part of how we have to think about the current era as opposed to past eras.
Well, thank you. It's all very helpful. I have one other question that I think it marries together one of the comments made by Dan and one of the comments made by Tom. Dan, I really liked your thought about, perhaps this presidential success is going to be greater in low salience issues. You suggested maybe the budget would be a relatively low salience issue in comparison to Social Security, more high-profile events and goals. And I guess the first question I'll ask about that is, there's a finding that we don't actually talk about in the book. It might be in a footnote, but it's not the kind of thing that gets much attention. Throughout our data sets on presidential budgetary requests and what gets passed in the end, we find that if you put in a variable that kind of counts how many years a war has been going on, we find that if anything, presidents do better as wars go on further, and this is true kind of across the full panel of wars that we consider. It's not a huge effect, but it's certainly not a diminishing. It's actually a positive, effect. So presidents are doing better as these wars go on, kind of throughout the admittedly short data. Shortened war, Iraq war, post 9/11 war, because that ends in our data set in 2005, but also Vietnam, Korean War. As we know, these wars are having certainly decreasing popularity. Public opinion is hurting them kind of throughout the progression of the war. What is it that you think would allow presidents to continue to do better in those events in these which is referring to as kind of low salience, less important events? As we know, they were struggling kind of with these larger events throughout as the wars progressed, as public opinion turned against them.
It's a great question, and it was actually one that I had in mind for you all because it's totally
okay. Well,
it's totally contrary to what your assumptions would be, which right. is that mm-hmm. the longer a war goes on, and particularly a war that becomes less popular
yes.
Or more unpopular, the less willing Congress would be to go along on some of these things. The only answer I would offer, and I'd defer to everybody else here, is sort of congressional inertia. I mean, that once things get built into spending patterns, they stay in spending patterns, and they're difficult to reverse unless there is some significant, person or move or, event that causes that to change. So, I mean, that's off the top of my head, that's the only thought I have, but I would welcome you all some thoughts on why that is, because it is counterintuitive.
Mm-hmm. Will, would you like to make a comment?
Yeah, I'll just say something quick, and I'm interested to hear what you all think as well about this. Thank you all for your great comments. On this point, I think we worried a lot about, what is it? I mean, there's sort of a core theme of the book is just trying to figure out what is it about war that's generating these effects particularly that we observe in domestic policy. What is it how's it changing our politics? And one story you could tell about war is that it boosts presidential approval ratings. It's one story to tell. But I actually don't think it comports with the evidence that we actually find. You don't see a big bump with the outbreak of the Persian Gulf War, right, for congressional acquiescence to the president and domestic policy. When you do observe a big bump in Bush 41's approval ratings, you see a big shift when you transition from war to peace in our data, in congressional voting behavior, and yet that isn't associated with big immediate shifts in presidential approval ratings. So I don't think that's so much the story. Also, but that's one line. What you might say is, what's going on with war? Another thing that you might point to is this blame avoidance idea that, members of Congress are just getting out of the way because they don't want to be fingered for blame when we are at war. If that's true, it seemed to me that then the effects should be greater in foreign policy. You really don't want to get blamed when the president is making decisions that are directly related to the war. And yet what we see are these big effects in domestic policy that are actually greater than those that we observe in foreign policy, which is why we're putting our money on it being about the net. When you say war, you want to think about its relevance for presidential power, you should think the nationalization of our politics, right? The extent to which that happens. That provides, I think, some consistent explanation for why we see the effects that we observe and why we can tie together post 9/11 period with World War II, even though on so many dimensions these are radically different military ventures, right? On so many dimensions, but they both had this effect. One thing I'll just say this one thing and then I'll get out of the way. looking at trends over the course of a war? Because, right, this, we were actually puzzled by this. You'd think that there would be a big bump initially, but you don't observe it. And then you'd see it sort of fade out. We simply don't see it in the data. But I think as a matter of principle, look, we don't have, if concerns about domestic policy over the course of a war shift to a set of local parochial considerations, if you see that shift, suddenly debates about education policy have to do with, you know, communities and local needs of kids and public versus private, as opposed to how do we keep the country competitive. That's the thing to monitor. When you see that shift to the parochial, from the national to the parochial, that's when presidents are going to have a harder time of it. And we want to argue it has less to do with whether or not the military venture itself is popular or not. That we just don't see evidence for. So I'll say that and get out of the way.
Great. Yeah. How are we doing on time here?
You can open it up.
We open it up for questions now. Are there anyone have any questions they'd like to ask? Is that Phil?
Hi, yes. Phil Wallach at Brookings. Is it really loud? So I was wondering how you distinguish between Congress accommodating what the president wants and the two things that they want just converging. So how do we know that presidents aren't tucking in their sails on these budget requests over time, as opposed to thinking that Congress is just acquiescing more?
That's a great question. So that's something we did look into in the book. And so in addition to kind of predicting the gap between the president's request and the enacted budget, we also estimate the president's request as a function of wartime versus peacetime. And we find that actually, if anything, presidents request more money during wartime, per agency or per program, than they do during times of peace. So if anything, they're actually, the president's pulling further away from where the budgets had been during times of war. Does that kind of address your question? Yes, right here.
It's very, very interesting. I have two questions. You seem to suggest that there are differences in congressional response or in public polls or whatever between what are now called wars of necessity and wars of choice. But the other question, unrelated and distinctive, I haven't heard any reference to the nature of congressional leadership and the skills of the congressional leadership within their own parties, or for that matter in bipartisan negotiations, and the relationships between the president and the leaders. That's the other side of the coin in the bilateral relationship.
Sure. I'll try to address that question if you guys want to add it too. What I would suggest is that congressional leaders, I mean, certainly have a voice here and they have their own expertise, but by the nature of our separation of powers, of our system of government, members of Congress are going to have a greater interest in learning how policies appeal or don't appeal to their given districts. So they're going to focus the majority of their interest or their attention on what their particular district or maybe their state, if they're a senator, what that state thinks, whereas the president's going to be much more concerned about the big picture. Maybe not the entire country. One could argue he focuses on the states that got him elected. You can get a little more fine-tuned with it, but certainly a much broader picture is what the president's going to be concerned with. So at any given time, he's assessing policy on a different set of criteria, so his expertise as a function of that will be a little bit different by nature than will be the members of Congress, even the leaders, who are by system of design going to think much more about local interests and how to earn their own re-election and appease their members of their constituents. Would either of you like to add in any comments to that?
Yeah, and going back to the earlier point,
he's got a mic for you here.
Oh, sorry.
Here I am again. The claim is not that during war, members of Congress check their local concerns at the door, that they just utterly abandon them. They care about both. It's that during some wars, they simply place greater weight on national implications, right? So it's just sort of a shift in priorities, but not an abandonment of local commitments. I really like the point earlier that was raised about the global economic meltdown, right? And I think this is something we're really open to. In some ways, we want to say wars are special because they can have the effect of nationalizing our politics. But that's not the only thing that could do that, right? We shouldn't think about there being a separate class of wartime politics and a separate class of domestic politics, right, or peacetime politics. It's that there are a number of things that could generate these effects. We point to and we talk about in the book the launching of Sputnik having this effect. But so, too, the global economic meltdown, if that has the effect of encouraging citizens to say, the sky is falling and it's falling on all of us as Americans, and it's challenging us to address, foreign competition in new and important ways, and it's, if that becomes the terms of the debate, the president's going to do better. If when the economic meltdown's kicking in and we all say, we got to take care of our communities and we got to recognize our diversity and we've got to, right? You could see it could have the shift of actually pointing towards more parochial concerns. The president's not going to do so well. And that's what we suggest is the sort of things to watch.
That's fascinating. Think TARP. Right. There's George Bush who gets a call from Secretary Paulson and Chairman Bernanke, the globe is melting, the sky is falling. We have to take action. We've major financial firms are going down. The bubble has burst. We have to take steps. President Bush hates it substantively, but.
But engages in presidential blame avoidance.
I think he engaged in presidential statesmanship and actually did what was required. But what's really interesting is how then party and public opinion, but also the nature of the problem itself sort of let... The public didn't respond in the face of this. Yes, we support our president and the Congress to bail out the banks and the other financial firms and to keep the ship of state afloat. But we're skeptical pretty early on, and this was so. What it took was an amazing combination of the other party coming forward and joining with the president, which left a bad aftertaste in the country and real problems. But the immediate sort of politics were very unusual, cutting against.
Look, we had a House vote and it failed, right? And so that's not the end of the story. What happened? How did we get to a successful Senate vote? How did we get to the final sort of coming together on TARP? I don't know. I think the local story mattered, right? They added Mental Health Parity Act, picked up a couple votes. right. President Obama called members of the Congressional Black Caucus, appealed to them. The foreclosure mitigation package got a little rounded out, which is local, right? That's a local issue. Yeah. And stock market crash, which I think generated both opposition to the bailouts as well as some recognition that everybody's 401ks or 403bs or what have you no longer look so good when you got them in the mail. But so it's a combination, clearly, of a combination there of trying to push the nationalization with these economic effects but members being moored in these partisan and electoral and different constituencies that make it tough, right, in this particular environment to get that type of nationalization effect, I think.
When there's a sense that it's falling,
we as a country are being hit by this, yeah. Right? We're all in this together. The economy is falling. What's to happen to us? I think in the immediate moment with TARP, there was more of that, and that it breaks out not into just the division between Main Street and Wall Street, but Main Streets, right? What are we going to do for all these forgotten communities around the country? And that we're hearing more of that in the rhetoric about how do we deal with the economic catastrophe, and that does not bode well for a president when you see that move away. That's the suggestion I make.
I believe you had your hand up a little while ago.
Thanks. Jennifer Victor at George Mason University. And to follow up on this conversation about the potential of exogenous events to nationalize our politics, I wondered if you could speak to what strikes me about both World War II and the post-9/11 wars is that they were both preceded by these dramatic attacks on the homeland. So and so that obviously allows for this nationalization of politics. So here's what I'm curious about as another potential exogenous effect and how this might play in your data, is not having had the benefit of reading the book yet, is the draft, right? So it seems to me that one of the ways that our military actions get nationalized, especially in World War II and wars after that, is the presence of the draft, where everybody knows somebody who's involved in these military actions. Well, after the draft is over and we have this more voluntary military, it seems the potential for exogenous events, in any event, to really nationalize our politics is dramatically decreased. And so I wonder if your data shows anything about the change before and after the draft, mandatory conscription, whether or not the ending of that reduces the ability of exogenous events to nationalize politics.
Nice. Thanks very much for the question and for coming. We thought about this issue about stateside attacks being the precipitator of these huge shifts. So unfortunately, we rely a lot on the budgetary data for one of our chapters, and so unfortunately, of course, there weren't budgetary requests by the president during World War I, not until 1922, so we couldn't do that for the World War I era. World War I, of course, had no stateside attack, per se. But so we replicated our roll call voting approach for World War I. We have a little bit less, there's a bit more noise in the estimates. However, for going into World War I, if you think that a stateside attack is the thing that sort of rallies the country, members of Congress around the president, then you wouldn't expect an effect for going into World War I. But in fact, we find there is in fact a huge effect in Congress for members of the House and Senate during 1917 being more supportive of President Wilson moving in the liberal direction upon our involvement in the war. So that cuts a little bit against the notion that it's only stateside attacks that precipitate these kind of effects. We haven't looked at the draft specifically. Certainly acknowledge that there are huge differences in how we fight wars now compared with World War II and previous wars where there was a mandatory draft, et cetera. There's other work, in fact, not to be too political science-y, but I think there's a paper coming out of the AJPS now or very soon that looks specifically at issues of drafts and their effects on local communities. It seems like maybe sort of throwing around the word war alone may not be sufficient for inducing huge changes in congressional support for the president. So I think that fundamentally thinking about how the nature of war is different now, what particularly 9/11 and the wars that followed bring this issue to the fore. We stop in the mid-2000s in the book just because we stop. I think that's a hugely important question for thinking about interbranch relations going forward. And maybe, I don't know, maybe we'll do some more research on that. We'll see. But you know, other people certainly should.
I guess that question over here.
Thanks very much. I'm Garrett Mitchell. I write the Mitchell Report. And I'm much of what was just posed in that question is what I've been thinking about. But I'll come at it at a different point of view. For me, the most remarkable moment in this whole session was looking at those posters and saying that was another country. As a consequence, I mean, you cannot imagine under any circumstances that if we were attacked tomorrow by bees or whatever, that there would ever be that kind of national response, and of course we use, as anyone who has read Dan Baltz's magnificent book on the 2012 election, it would be Twitter. It wouldn't be posters. And so, Mike, the question is, I was thinking about, so, okay, so that was that America. This is a new America. What's changed? Certainly, one of the most important things that's changed is no draft and the extent to which that nationalized the war. I believe that technology is a major player here, and I mean both war related technology and communications technology. And so I'm wondering whether it is possible to answer the question in the abstract about whether presidents' ability to get their agendas accomplished during wartime can be answered historically if the country has changed to the extent that this country has and the new factors like the draft, like the technology, et cetera. I'm wondering how you come to some sort of conclusion like that other than with an answer that says it depends. It depends on whether we were attacked. It depends on how long the war goes on. And I just would stop this stream of consciousness by saying that probably the single greatest criticism that many people have of George Bush was the failure post 9/11 to call on the country to make sacrifices, to do a gasoline tax, to do whatever it needs to be done, and that if he had his presidency might have had a different arc. There's a question in there somewhere, I promise you. Comma, what do you think?
There we go. Thank you. I'm afraid that I feel like I do need to leave you with a "it does depend" kind of answer. Because, and Will kind of alluded to this a little bit, and John as well. But in the book, we have a chapter that kind of delves into each of these wars and tries to tease out what made each war different, and what ways are they the same, what factors are the same about them. And you can, there are so many different ways you can think about differences and similarities of these wars. You know, you can try to compare the number of casualties, how long was the war, money spent, all kinds of different factors, and try to think about wars changing over the course of a war, or these variables changing, and public opinion changing, as we talked about earlier. And the presence or absence of a draft, presence or absence of a stateside attack that precipitates the war, and some wars have that, some don't. I think what we kind of came to in the book, and this is how I feel about it, no single factor, a stateside attack, a draft, a casualty count, can predict the ability of the president to extract concessions from Congress. It has to be thought of as kind of a conglomeration of several different factors that build, throughout a war. And I think in a lot of ways that sets our work apart from others, where you might point to a rally around the flag effect that just when the war starts, it's a war, and public opinion kicks in, and you just follow public opinion, and you'll understand how the president's doing. I think in a lot of ways we're saying it's a lot more complicated than that, and you have to look at the full panel of factors that shape each war. And that's why we find that some wars matter and some don't. So it does depend. The whole story of our book is that you can't just say a war will produce this effect. You have to look at how much it nationalizes the politics. So it very much does depend, unfortunately. I wish we had a stronger bullet point answer, but that's where I would leave it. I think I saw several hands. I thought this one would go up first.
Thanks. Rob McGrath, Jordan Mason as well. Do you identify any other sources of variation in this national focus versus local focus? I'm thinking of maybe like electoral effects. So when senators are up for re-election, might they behave differently from when they first enter? Do you find differences in voting patterns in election years in the House? Also, do you find at the individual legislator level, perhaps distinctions between regions? Like are legislators from certain regions more likely to see events as national versus local, or are actually the other way around, more likely to see things as local versus national when the rest of the country is seeing it as national?
John, can you speak to that?
Yes, I can speak to part of it. Yeah.
Yeah.
So we looked a little bit for members of the 107th Senate and House, who were more likely to exhibit the larger shifts in voting behavior. And so for the Senate, we looked at people who were up for re-election in 2002 versus those who are not. We might think there might be different kind of electoral pressures on those, and we didn't find any differences with respect to whether or not senators were up for re-election in 2002. For the House, so we looked at the presidential vote share that President Bush received in their district in 2000. So for Democratic members of the House, we saw that those that were from districts where Bush received a larger percentage of the vote in 2000, they exhibited much larger shifts than Democrats that were from more liberal districts. So there clearly are some electoral incentives that members are responding to here. And I think to talk to the issue of how these events can nationalize our politics in electoral campaigns. So Dick Gephardt commented in 2002 that of course Republicans are going to do well. The nature of the war has fundamentally shifted the policy agenda in such a way that it advantages the Republicans. So Democrats are just at a structural advantage to dare defy the president on these things he wants to prioritize. So elections clearly do play a role here in inducing changes in member voting behavior. And there is something about the nationalizing of politics that shifts the ways that we talk about political issues and the ways that members of Congress think about the positions they take on various bills or proposals that come up. So elections absolutely are crucial for thinking this through too.
I think we're about out of time. Maybe we'll do one last question. We have time for one more question, and then we'll have to close out.
Thank you, Yusuf Bulinai, National Defense University. To dovetail my colleague's question regarding electoral politics, I was wondering if you were tempted to see any kind of spikes during a presidential election year. For instance, I'm thinking FDR, the crowded field of Huey Long, America First, Lindbergh supporting America First. I'm thinking, of course, LBJ and Goldwater and the Daisy commercial. These kind of, is there any spikes in your data because of the personalities, if you will, involved in an election year? Thank you.
Do you have anything you'd like to say? I don't remember any particular patterns.
Let me just suggest, our claim about the conditional effects of war on presidential power is an all else equal claim. It's that, right, all else equal, when our politics is nationalized via a war, the president should do better. And what you might say is, yeah, but some presidents are different from other presidents. The economy is different. The draft is different. And so the turning over the rocks, which is boring work, but essential work, like statistically, was an effort to try to attend to precisely these sorts of things. So we include, for instance, in a lot of the analysis, so this is a statistical thing. We include separate identifiers for each president, right, to sort of net out the effect of each individual president and look at changes within presidents. Likewise with members of Congress. Right? Democrats might be different from Republicans. That's true. So we're going to look at changes within Republicans, within Democrats, and to try to pin down what is what we think is an essential part of our politics, which is nationalization goes up, president does better, and the nationalization can be induced by, isn't exclusively induced by, but it can be induced by at least some wars. And that's the sort of take-home message we're hoping people take away from it.
I don't need two microphones. I think we're all done. Thank you all very much for coming here. Thank you, Sarah Binder, Tom Mann, Dan Balls, William Howell, John Rogowski. Thank you all for your comments, and have a good day.